I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, joins me. The headlines are not just about the Black Sea Basin this week. They span world-scale conflicts, including, of course, the immediate one about FIFA and the awarding of the 2018 World Cup to Moscow, now in question because of the scandal, the indictments, the allegations by the Justice Department. However, the headlines also include financial news that is critical to understanding Kiev and its margin of success waiting for Minsk II to be acted upon. So a very good evening to you. I begin with the routine nod to the reports. This is Newsweek's report of Russian troops and armored vehicles massing on Ukrainian border as evidence, we're told, of makeshift Russian bases. We also have routine reports of Russian weapon systems inside Ukraine in the Donbass. From there, however, economic reports surprising from the World Bank on June 1st, Russia's economy will continue to experience growth 2016. The World Bank is expecting the Russian economy after the European and U.S. sanctions to contract 2.7% 2015, but it will grow again in 2016 to 0.7% and in 2017 2.7%. I mention that 2.7 because that's higher than the United States has experienced these years of the Great Recession. Also, this is significant and Steve will have much to say of it. The significance of this appointment. Ukrainian government appoints former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili to be governor of Ukraine's Odessa region. Odessa is on the coastline of the Black Sea. It is a very important port. It's been important for a long time. It was sometimes a conflict zone, but right now it is the scene of an investigation still pending of the massacre of May of 2014 of Russian sympathizers by unknown. Saakashvili most recently was seen in the streets of Brooklyn, New York. That's right, carrying a Starbucks after he was riding on his bicycle. But suddenly now he is said to be a citizen of Ukraine in some fashion, and he's governor of Ukraine's Odessa region. And finally, this news is hard to characterize as accurate or confirmed, but there are widespread reports of hacktivists, that's what they're called, breaking into files of George Soros, the global financier, documents that date to as recently as March of 2015. And these documents point to George Soros and his agents, very involved in these last decades of transforming what was the Soviet Union into an open society with many NGOs planted throughout Eastern Europe. Mr. Soros is very actively involved in designing what is going on in Ukraine, what he wants to go on in Ukraine, not only financially, because he's a financial wizard, the man who broke the pound back in the 20th century, but also militarily. We'll speak to all this and more. Welcoming the professor. Steve, I want to begin with the FIFA news. Here's what it is. The president of FIFA recently reelected last Friday the 29th, for his fifth term. His name is Blatter. His nickname is Seb. He's called Seb Blatter. Has now resigned pending a new election at FIFA from his post. This following the indictment, the allegations and indictment and pending transfer of seven senior officials of FIFA from many states to the United States, being charged with corruption, influence peddling, taking bribes, lots of evidence. Loretta Lynch, the new attorney general, made this announcement spectacularly last week. The question was, what would Blatter do? He was not named in the original indictments, although there is speculation now he will be involved in another wave of indictments. The investigation is in early stages. Switzerland is also conducting an investigation. Most importantly, this has to do with the awarding of the World Cup 2018 to Russia, where there are allegations of bribery, influence, peddling. Mr. Putin, significantly, was one of the loudest voices last week defending Seb Blatter after the original allegations and challenging the idea that the United States had anything to do with the World Cup or with the awarding of the World Cup 2018 in Moscow. Because 2018 is also an election cycle for the Russians, Mr. Putin is expected to stand for his fourth term. Is this a problem for Vladimir Putin? And is defense of Seb Blatter now part of the story of the new Cold War? Good evening to you, Steve.
Well, it's not a problem for Putin inside Russia, because from left to right, the reaction to to this FIFA investigation has been outrage. Russia perceives it as directed against Russia. And that's why, within hours of the announcement of the indictments, Putin kind of astonished the world. People said, what's he doing? It's not about Russia. Immediately made a statement denouncing the investigations. And the reaction in the West and the newspapers is, what's he talking about? This is, Russia wasn't mentioned. But that's incorrect. On the day that the Swiss announced the indictments in Switzerland, the Swiss Attorney General, and I read, said that the investigation was directed toward the allocation of money involving the assignment of the 2018 games to Russia. So from the very beginning, it was stated by the Attorney General of Switzerland. I don't think this was mentioned by the Attorney General in the United States, but that part of the corruption had involved awarding the games to Russia. What we see, John, is more confirmation, not that we need it, but more confirmation that we are living now in an authentic Cold War. People old enough to remember will remember the boycott of the World Olympic Games in Russia in 1980. And that has never been forgotten about by Russia. They will remember just this past January a failed but attempted boycott of the World Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia. And I think it's fair to say a campaign against those games in the Western press on the grounds that they were corrupt, on the grounds that there was going to be terrorism. The games actually were immensely successful for the world, for Russia, and for Putin personally. But now we have this Cold War reflex that suddenly these symbolic sports events that are meant to exemplify international solidarity and friendship and honest, clean competition are now going to become highly politicized. I don't know whether there was corruption. Probably there was. There almost always is in the awarding of these ultra-lucrative sports events. But that it would spread so quickly to Russia, particularly in the aftermath of what happened at the Sochi Olympics, shows you this Cold War continues to spread and is really being driven by powerful forces and will soon be totally out of control.
Mention, Steve, and you've commented that many Russian oligarchs are deeply involved in commercial soccer, international football. They own very big franchises worldwide. So Russia's not a casual participant like an outsider to the Olympics. This is integral to the success of the oligarchs.
That's right, and these games are important on several levels to Russia. Above all, it's very prestigious. It further enhances Putin's reputation as the man who rebuilt Russia and returned it to the world stage. It brings Russia money, prestige, international attention for a long period of time when the games occur. The idea that the games could be taken from Russia, though there's no question that this is a campaign. Senator McCain, for example, the American Senator McCain, John McCain, has demanded for years that the decision to give Russia the games be revoked, and he's not alone. So there will be a campaign. But stop and think for a minute what it would mean. First of all, what would be the validity of awarding games by the new administration of FIFA in the future to any country? It would be highly politicized, challengeable. Opponents of the decision, and particularly countries that wanted the games and didn't get it, would create political scandals. Secondly, Russia has already spent probably billions, but certainly hundreds of millions of dollars preparing infrastructure, stadiums, and all the rest. They will go into international courts and sue to get that money back. I doubt very seriously that even the anti-Russian factions in the world football community would go this far, but it's going to be a political issue. On another level, you're absolutely right. The most famous Russian oligarch in the world of what they call football, we call soccer, it's the same game, is Roman Abramovich, who lives in London, who owns the famous Chelsea football team. However, there are seven or eight other very wealthy Russian oligarchs who own either controlling shares or large minority shares in football teams around the world. So Russia is embedded, so to speak, financially, in the international soccer community. Whether for better or worse, I don't know. But I mean, and don't forget, this is not the only case. A Russian oligarch owns the New York NBA basketball team, the Brooklyn Nets. This is one way that oligarchs who had rather shadowy, shady, nasty reputations when they accumulated their fortunes have done two things. Try to embellish their public reputations as benefactors of sports, and to move their money offshore out of Russia. So it's a large, complicated political financial gambit that they played for 15 or 20 years. And now, if they're influential in seven or eight major football teams, or soccer teams, it's kind of hard to see how they can exclude Russia.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, we're going to turn to Kiev versus Minsk II when we come back. And Saakashvili, isn't he a Georgian? What's he doing in Ukraine? I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University is here. Saakashvili. Mikhail Saakashvili was a hero to the headlines back in 2007, 2008, especially during the conflict where Russia invaded Ukraine, picked it apart, Abkhazia and part of the Ukraine was ceded or taken or annexed by Russia and still sits within Russia. South Ossetia was another part of Ukraine. Saakashvili was seen confronting the Russian military and was celebrated at the time. He since then has moved on. The leadership in Russia is in Georgia is much more mixed today. However, the last time I checked, Saakashvili was in Brooklyn, and now he's been named to be governor of the Odessa province in Ukraine. Steve, can we regard this as a blow to Minsk II? Is Saakashvili someone associated with anti-Putin no matter what?
I think so. And I think the appointment, not only is it just plain weird that a foreign citizen, a former president of another country, would be appointed a governor of Ukraine. And by the way, let's remember, in Ukraine, this so-called beacon of democracy, they appoint governors. The president does. They're not elected. Most of the governors are Ukrainian oligarchs. And one reason that the president of Ukraine appointed Saakashvili, again, he has to resign his Georgian citizenship. So as of now, whether he's filed the papers or not, he is no longer a Georgian citizen, which, I should add, many Georgians regard with some pleasure. Let's put him in context. He came to power in Georgia, the small former Soviet republic in the Caucasus, through elections. He was heralded as a great reformer and a great Democrat. He did carry out some reforms. Probably the most famous one was his purging of corruption from the Georgian police force. But as time went on, he abused power. It's well documented. He committed human rights violations. Lots of corruption surrounded him personally. He was defeated in election, and he left the country. And he's under indictment in Georgia, under criminal indictment. There's an international warrant out for his arrest. He was first in Brooklyn, as you say, and now he's found sanctuary in Ukraine. But his claim to fame, if that's it, is the war of 2008, as you mentioned, which was a proxy war between Russia and the U.S.-backed Georgian army. And that war, though it didn't last long, almost led, we know from discussions that were held in the Bush White House at the time, to an open American-Russian war. Many people say Russia invaded Georgia in 2008, but the international investigations of what happened all document that Saakashvili, then the president of Georgia, attacked Russian protectorates, it's true, inside Georgia's borders, but they were protectorates mandated by the United Nations. Russia had virtually no choice but to react by entering the country. So Saakashvili is a detonator. His loathing for Russia generally and for Putin in particular is famous or infamous, depending on how you feel about him. Odessa, one of the historic jewels of Russian-Ukrainian civilization, but was considered to be one of the great mixing pots, as we would call it, of world civilization, Russians and Ukrainians and Jews and all, multicultural in the fullest sense, has become, because of the proxy war between Russia and the United States over Ukraine now, absolutely explosive by all reports. So suddenly the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, names as the governor of this ticking time bomb a guy who never saw a bomb he didn't want to detonate. So I regard this as an escalation of the crisis. There are various explanations being given about why Poroshenko appointed Saakashvili. One being he didn't have anybody in Ukraine to appoint. Ukraine's a very large country. That seems preposterous. Secondly, there's a lot of corruption in Odessa, and that Saakashvili is good at cleaning up corruption. But I think there's one we ought to consider. We can't prove it, but we should watch it. Saakashvili remains a hero to the neocon faction in Washington. Remember, it was Senator John McCain
right.
who went to Georgia. Later, he would go to Ukraine, but first, like an agent of the old Communist International, first he went to Georgia, stood in Georgia, and said, "We are all now Georgians." That is, he embraced Saakashvili fully, and many of the political operatives who worked for Ukraine later went to Georgia to work for Saakashvili.
I want to recover, Steve, that Joe Biden, now Vice President of the United States, was also someone who stood by Saakashvili that summer, and the speculation is that that brought him to the attention of Barack Obama, who was looking around for a vice president, and might have lent a strength to Mr. Biden above the other candidates.
That's possible, but the more important point I would say in mentioning Biden is that it reminds us that this interventionist American foreign policy is fully bipartisan.
Right. Yes.
I mean, McCain and Biden, so far as we can tell from their public reports, see absolutely eye to eye on Russia, on this crisis, on Georgia, and now on Saakashvili.
Let's move to Russia because I want to. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, Princeton University, NYU, Russian History Emeritus. When we come back, more on Saakashvili and then the wider new Cold War. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here. Professor Cohen has been with me for many years. I think we're approaching our second decade on air, talking about Russia. Once upon a time, I recover, Steve repeatedly said, this is around the turn of the century, this century, Russia will not always be on its knees. Well, here we are in 2015, and we could say the bear is standing and doing very well, thank you very much, threatening to its neighbors, question mark, but also allying with China. The larger conflict now is the new Cold War in the 21st century. I recover a moment, however, in 2008, before and after the Georgian crisis, and we've been discussing this, and Steve has more to say about it. I recall very clearly Steve coming on this air and saying, listen, Ukraine is the one that means war. Georgia is a conflict, and the United States will demonstrate and sympathize, and Russia will pull it apart, but it's not worth war. It's not what Putin will fight over. He will, however, fight over Ukraine. Here we are 7 years later, and that's what we've got, with reports of Russian military units on the border of Ukraine, with routine reports of Russian soldiers or volunteers or some form of Russian military in Donbass, with Crimea under the control of the Russian military now annexed. Nuclear weapons on Crimea are mentioned as well. All of that is what the professor was pointing to back in 2008 when Saakashvili was the hero president standing up to the Russian bear, and Vladimir Putin rushed from the Olympics in Beijing back to Moscow to take charge personally of the tearing apart of Georgia and the settling of that dispute. Remember all that? Well, here we are, Steve. I recover all that because I'm not shoving the crystal ball against to you and saying what's next. But you saw this, many people saw this conflict 7 years ago. The surprise, Steve, is did McCain see it? Senator McCain, did Joe Biden, Vice President Biden, did they see that Ukraine would trigger this scale of crisis?
I don't think they saw it would trigger this scale of crisis, though I'm also not sure they really are unhappy that it has. They seem to be feasting on it. But the answer is yes. The United States, at the highest level, has been operating in Ukraine since the Soviet Union ended. Victoria Nuland, who is the State Department agent who's been most involved in Ukraine in the last 2 years, told the Senate that over this period, going back to the 1990s, the United States had given $5 billion to Ukraine for democracy promotion, whatever that means. Some people think it means regime change. But Biden and McCain have been advocates of this policy from the beginning. Both have turned Saakashvili into a hero, although it should be said that he is a hero in his own former country, Georgia, to increasingly few people. In fact, it's possible there are reports that his own political party in Georgia is kind of happy that he's no longer a Georgian citizen because he can't be the titular head of the party, which will have to go into election soon, and they see him as a burden, as not a help electorally. He's not popular in Georgia anymore. But look, here's the larger point. Appointing Saakashvili, the governor of Odessa, an area not unlike Donbass, for example, in the sense that many Russians, or Crimea, to take the better example, now a next part of Russia, many Russians see it as historically part of Russia, not of Ukraine. We don't have to debate that issue. The political point is many Russians see it that way. And when Putin receives pressure from the hardliners in Russia to be more aggressive in eastern and southern Ukraine, they have in mind Odessa already. I met a citizen of Odessa when I was in Europe in March. She seemed a very sensible, educated woman. She works as a staffer at the European Parliament in Brussels. And she said that for the Russian population, Russian-speaking population of Odessa, it now feels like a city under occupation, occupied by Kiev. If that's a widespread perception in Odessa, to send Saakashvili there, and there's hardly a more anti-Russian, anti-Putin figure available, looks like a provocation. The question in my mind is, who dreamt it up? Did it come from Washington? Did it come from people who want a provocation? Did it come from people for whom Minsk is something to be defeated, this attempt to negotiate an end of the crisis? So I think this is something to watch very, very carefully. Saakashvili is a ticking time bomb himself, and what will happen when he gets there? And after all, it is a bit odd. It's true, by the way, we should say on his behalf, that he has biographical ties to Ukraine. I think he went to university in Kiev. He knows a lot of people, a lot of members of the elite. So he's not a stranger to Ukraine, but he's not a Ukrainian. I mean, imagine naming, I don't know, a Frenchman, the governor of New York, if we were appointing governors.
Steve, I went to school in Scotland. I'm not looking to be a member of parliament, okay? It's just, it's a stretch here. It looks like they have a purpose for him, and we've speculated.
It looks like there's a political agenda. Really does.
And I note that he has a profile in New York and New York papers, and, you know, he looked pretty good hanging out in Brooklyn. It's very strange. He's a young man. He's a Columbia Law School graduate, is my memory.
Yep.
So he's well-educated in several continents. He's exactly the kind of person you'd push before a microphone because his English is excellent. I'm just wondering if they're entertaining a presidency for him. In any event, I want to speak to the larger Cold War. You make a point in a comment to me that Russia's ambition for liberalization and democratization is defeated by Cold War. That happened in the 20th century. Is it happening again?
Well, those of us who lived through and studied the American-Soviet Cold War understood, most of us did, that when the Cold War got colder, the chances for liberalization, and they were always present, in the Soviet Union diminished. And when international relations improved, periods of what we then called détente, the chances for liberalization from above, because that's where it was coming from in the Soviet Union, grew. And we have the historic proof of this. When Gorbachev came to power 30 years ago in 1985, we know that he already had in mind very, very far-reaching, I think, even radical reforms inside the Soviet Union. But he knew when he came to power, as did the dozen very well-educated men who were part of his team and who knew a lot about international affairs and about their own system, that Gorbachev's domestic reforms would not be possible given the intensity of the Cold War as it was in 1984-1985. Remember, in 1983, the Soviets shot down a Korean passenger airliner that had meandered on purpose or by accident, we still don't know, over Soviet territory. What was the second thing Gorbachev did when he became leader of the Soviet Union? He reached out to the most Cold War American president ever, Ronald Reagan. And he did so for two reasons. Gorbachev himself believed the Cold War was very bad and spinning out of control. Secondly, he knew that if he couldn't wind down the Cold War, he couldn't carry out his reforms. And to his enormous credit, Reagan met Gorbachev halfway. Very early on, by the way, they met in Geneva shortly. I went there. I was working for CBS at the time. I went to observe it with CBS. But the two men, so unlike in so many ways, met in Geneva. And you could see right there they'd formed a partnership. They had something in common. They both wanted to wind down the nuclear arms race. But without that act of, let's call it, radical detente, diminishing the Cold War, Gorbachev never could have got his reforms started in the Soviet system. What we're seeing today in Russia is the reverse, that as the Cold War returns, as it gets worse, Russia, which has been in a ziggy-zaggy process of democratization for 20 years, diminishing under Putin, but by no means dead, that the anti-liberal, anti-democratizing forces inside Russia have gained great strength since this began. And the worse it gets internationally, the worse the situation gets inside Russia itself. Though there are a lot of interesting countervailing trends, Putin being at the center of them.
About Vladimir Putin, Steve, there's so much emphasis on Vladimir Putin in the United States media and television all the time. I don't know if it's also true in Europe. I see the BBC. That's all I see there. The focus on Putin, is that well directed given the scale of interlocking power bases that I know exist in Russia, all the cities and the regions, the oligarchs? And Putin is not a young man. And there are new generations looking for leadership in the military, in state security, where Putin comes from, but also in industry. And the focus on Putin, it's as if he disappeared tomorrow, all this would be settled. Is that an accurate picture?
Well, it's half accurate in the sense that historically, traditionally, the executive, from czars to commissars to Putin, have had more power than any other branch of government. There's never been an effective, lasting separation of power in Russia. That's a pity. That's the Russian tradition. That's the tragedy, by the way, of the end of Gorbachev's reforms, which were built as he gave away his own power. He literally was giving away his own power. There may be no precedent for this in history. He was giving away his own power as general secretary, or president as he became, in the Soviet system in order to create a legislative elected branch. He was trying to create a Russian parliament, and he was semi-successful until the experiment ended. Putin, on the other hand, but this began under Yeltsin. Remember, the Russian constitution today is what they call a super presidential constitution. All the effective power is in the hands of the president. But that constitution was written and passed under Yeltsin, not under Putin, and long before Putin even came on the scene. But that is the Russian tradition. That said, however, Russia is a vast country, largest territorial country in the world, with bureaucratic elites who are bred to learn how to evade and resist orders from Moscow. They've done it for centuries. Anybody who's seen comic operas or read Gogol about the rule in Tsarist Russia knows that it's an art form, that Russian provincial officials are artful dodgers in pretending to obey the orders of Moscow while either ignoring them or doing something different. Putin said I believe it was Putin or his press secretary said, 3 or 4 years ago, that only 30% of the president's orders are implemented. 30%. That's rather high in Russia, actually. Putin was doing better than most. Second factor is that most political scientists who are not involved in this demonizing Putin business have concluded that after Putin was appointed by Yeltsin and elected president, he consolidated his power not by dictating to the rival power elites and lobbies around him, but negotiating, moderating, balancing their interests. That's the way he's always ruled. The problem is now that there's this international crisis, and that's created a kind of crisis of authority and governance inside Russia itself. So we see in Russia today a kind of tug between the Russian tradition of elevating the leader, the czar, the commissar, or Putin, to a kind of autocratic status, though Putin doesn't have autocratic power. There are some elites that would like for him to have this supreme power, and other tendencies, other historical traditions, other elites that want to keep Putin in place, but not his power over them. They want him to protect their turf. This is not a revelation. This is the way Russia has always been governed. Khrushchev, by the way, once said brilliantly, it would take three academy of sciences to govern Russia wisely. You understand his point, that governing Russia is really difficult. Stalin did it by terror. Gorbachev tried to do it by democracy. Putin is doing it through a kind of, I would say, I hate to use the word, but soft authoritarianism. And by the way, even though it would be easy to point out things that Putin is doing in Russia today that are bad for democratization, bad for liberalization, like cracking down on NGOs, by limiting the space that oppositionists have to operate, by narrowing the freedom of speech in Russia, it's also possible at the very same moment, simultaneously, to point out things that Putin is doing that seem to be contradictory. For example, symbolically very important, he just appointed the oldest, most famous, and greatest living representative of human rights, a woman named Ludmila Alexeyevna, whom I knew in Russia back in the 1970s, to his Human Rights Council. I mean, he was saying, and because she's a fabled, she's in her 80s, maybe approaching 90, she's a fabled symbol of resistance to central power in Russia. He's appointed her to his Human Rights Advisory Council. And meanwhile, I think I mentioned this before when we talked, Putin has signed a decree, using his power, presidential decree, putting federal budgetary funds behind it to build a monument to Stalin's millions of victims.
We've talked about
that. Right in the center of Moscow.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, when we come back, we're going to turn momentarily to the war party, because while we speak of the new Cold War, we have some facts thanks to hacktivists and George Soros's indiscretions. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and we just have a few moments because of a document that comes our way. No guarantee. There's no transparency here. It's hacking, after all. These are so-called hacktivists. You can go to Zero Hedge and see a write-up of the financial details of this document. This dates from March of 2015. In other words, within these last 3 months. And in the section titled State of Play, this is George Soros, who signs the document. Ukraine. Two names are mentioned and one group. I will read the document. General Wesley Clark, of United States Army, retired. Polish General Skripchak. Polish General Skripchak, Waldemar Skripchak, was a commander of the Polish Land Forces 2006 to 2009. And as of this document and Wikipedia, he is named as Deputy Minister of Defense, responsible for armament and modernization as of right now. So two generals. Clark and Skripchak and a few specialists under the auspices of the Atlantic Council will advise President Poroshenko how to restore the fighting capacity of Ukraine without violating the Minsk Agreement. Steve, The theme here in this paper is financial and military resistance to the Minsk agreement. This is the war party. Soros is pushing no solution. He's pushing resistance at all costs against Vladimir Putin. And even games at the end of this document, what Putin will do in July after the European Union makes a decision about sanctions. And he's pointing to a re-escalation, he says, of the military conflict. Have we got names, Steve, here? Can we trust this? Kripchak of Poland, that would fit everything we've seen. Poland is the war party. And Wesley Clark, he's a general for hire, and Soros has him.
I can think of nothing to add, assuming that your listeners have followed us at least some of the time over the last nearly 2 years, that the struggle over Ukraine, the confrontation between the United States, NATO on one side, and Russia on the other, continues to intensify. The danger of actual war looms. Two political groups around the world have formed. One wants to settle this through negotiation. They created the Minsk Accords, which is a roadmap of negotiation. The other group has struck back by intensifying its warfare policies. It's financial. That's Soros speaking. He's ready to give Ukraine billions of dollars. By the way, according to these leaks, Soros said that not all that money had to be used for economic reform. Presumably it would be used for the military. In the United States, the pro-Kiev, pro-warfare party is almost unchallenged. In Kiev itself, and remember, the president of Kiev, Poroshenko, went to Minsk and agreed with Chancellor Merkel of Germany and President Hollande of France and with Putin to these Minsk diplomatic accords.
Right.
But Poroshenko himself and Kiev in general, the leadership there, is now speaking war again.
We have a minute, Steve. Does Soros, at this point, make a choice? To your reading, does he want war back or does he want financial advantages? Can we tell?
I am baffled by his public behavior since the crisis began. He is, I think, 82, maybe a bit more, the umpteenth richest man in the world. It's hard to see exactly why he's been so uncharacteristically both aggressive and public as a lobbyist for the war party. One can speculate whether it's financial, whether it's political, whether it's philosophical, whether he really believes that Kiev is a beacon of democracy.
We'll wait for Soros or his representatives to comment on the accuracy of these documents that are hacked. You can find them everywhere. There's George Soros, Ukraine. You'll read them for yourselves. This is a plan for war or question mark. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, Ukraine Crisis will continue in the coming weeks. I'm John Batchelor.